Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
If you hate flying, you might not want to listen to this episode of the Council of Trent podcast. But maybe it will actually reassure you. You never know. Why not give it a chance? Hi, I'm your host, Trent Horn, and welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. And it's Free for All Friday, which means I get to talk about a whole host of different topics that I find interesting, and I think you will find interesting too. And I noticed I haven't done a disaster-themed podcast in a while. When the podcast first started, I really enjoyed doing episodes on disasters, both natural and man-made, aviation incidents, ships sinking. I know it seems morbid, but you know, I'm fascinated by these incidents and finding out what went wrong. And a lot of other people are too, because when you find out what goes wrong in these scenarios, you learn how to prevent that from happening in the future. So that's what we're going to talk about today here on the Council of Trent podcast, when pilots crash and save planes. So I've got three incidents where pilot error led to planes crashing, and also two incidents where it was the effort and skill of the pilots that saved planes that almost certainly would have been doomed. Those are wonderful stories. So it's kind of like when people say to you, do you want the good news or the bad news? I always want the bad news first, because I'm never going to be able to enjoy the good news if I'm waiting for the bad news. So I figured I'd do the same thing with the podcast today, that I'll share with you stories of the plane incidents where pilot error ended in catastrophe, but then I think I'll redeem it with stories of where pilot skill and bravery managed to save the aircraft. Before I get to that, though, just a reminder, be sure to visit TrenthornPodcast.com. If you want to keep hearing great episodes like this and enjoy access to bonus content, there's only one place to do that. Go and consider becoming a member to support our podcast at TrenthornPodcast.com for as little as $5 a month to get access to bonus content, and you keep the podcast on the airwaves. Airwaves? Internet? I guess we're not being broadcast on radio yet, but you never know what will happen in the future. All right, let's start with the first one. Air France 447. This is one I've been obsessed with for a long time. I've seen probably three or four different documentaries on this particular incident. And by the way, I'm going to play clips that include reenactments as well as actual air traffic control recordings and cockpit voice recordings from these incidents. What's sad, though, I went on YouTube to try to find these, and there used to be all kinds of air crash investigation and seconds from disasters, like full episodes online, but I think that they've been taken down. So I'm sure you can only find them streaming somewhere else, not on YouTube. Because I used to be able to find all these documentaries to watch for free, just posted on YouTube. Now they're not there, so I'll have to search somewhere else to find them. So let's begin with Air France Flight 447. This is according to Wikipedia. This was a scheduled Air France international passenger flight from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil to Paris, France on June 1st, 2009. The Airbus A330 serving the flight stalled and did not recover, eventually crashing into the Atlantic Ocean at 2:14 a.m., killing all 228 passengers and crew on board. The Brazilian Navy removed the first major wreckage and two bodies from the sea within 5 days of the accident. But the initial investigation by France's Investigation Bureau was hampered because the aircraft's flight recorders were not recovered from the ocean floor until May 2011, nearly 2 years later. I actually saw a documentary on this incident that was recorded and broadcast before the flight data recorders were recovered. So people were speculating about what happened, what could have caused a plane to crash like this. Because usually, like when I fly, now, normally, I'm not afraid to fly. I don't have any fear of flying. I fly probably once every 2 weeks. But still, I get a little bit of anxiety just in general. But for me, I'm usually happy when we take off and we pass 10,000 feet. Because for me, the most harrowing part of flying is, and really this is the most dangerous part of flying, is takeoff and landing. Because the margin for error is incredibly small. I mean, think about it. You're taking off, you're going, 200 miles an hour. If something goes wrong, you smash into something at 200 miles an hour, that's it. And you don't have any room for error. You can't recover. So we're going to talk about another plane that had a stall at 2,000 feet that managed to recover, which is extremely unheard of because you have barely any time because you start falling right away. So for me, if a plane can get above 10,000 feet, I know, hey, we're pretty fine. If something does happen, Commercial airliners have redundant safety systems in place so that if there's even a hint of danger, the flight is immediately diverted. In fact, I'm recording this episode just a day or two after news broke of a Delta flight from Atlanta to Fort Lauderdale was diverted. It dropped several thousand feet in a few minutes. It was diverted to Tampa. And there's pictures of people, the oxygen masks come down and people were freaking out. And the flight attendant said, don't panic. But that's the one thing that will send you in a panic, right? If you hear somebody say to you, do not panic. It's like when you tell someone, don't think of pink elephants. What do you got? A pink elephant. Don't think of panicking pink elephants. Oh, I've got panicking pink elephants. That was not a great procedure for the flight attendant. You should just say, maybe not brace because the captain hadn't said to brace, but put on your oxygen masks, look forward, sit back. It's better to give someone just directions of what to do in a crisis situation than of what not to do, like saying not to panic. But that flight turned out just fine. But the thing is, yeah, when you take off, you want to get high enough so that you have room to work with. So the thing with Air France 447 makes it very rare, like people couldn't figure out what happened until they got the flight recorders, is that it's just unheard of for planes to just drop out of the sky without warning. Like when a plane is flying, I mean, if all the systems are just completely damaged, you know, stop working, the plane can still fly. It just turns into a glider, basically. But as it's going so fast, like when you feel the plane kind of bump a little bit from turbulence, that's just like kind of going over a speed bump. It's not like the plane, because we get this feeling, and I get the feeling too, when you're in a plane 30,000 feet in the air, you feel like this plane is like hanging by a string. And like if that string cut, it would just fall and start falling. But really, because of the speed that it's going at, the air underneath it, it's almost thick. It's like jelly. It can't just fall like that because it's going at such speed. So that's why a 447, it crashed in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, which made it hard to recover the flight recorder. People wondered, well, what happened? How does a plane just drop out of the sky like this? That just doesn't happen. Most accidents with planes are on takeoff or landing, not in the middle of flight. So what happened? According to the article, the final report released at a news conference on July 5th, 2012, concluded that the aircraft crashed after temporary inconsistencies between the airspeed measurements, likely due to the aircraft's pitot tubes being obstructed by ice crystals, caused the autopilot to disconnect, after which the crew reacted incorrectly and ultimately caused the aircraft to enter an aerodynamic stall from which it did not recover. So basically what happened was, this is the safest part of the flight. It's going over the Atlantic Ocean, it's entering the tropic zone, so there's a little bit of weather, but nothing unusual for the plane to handle. So the captain goes to take his first break. He goes to sleep. It's a transatlantic flight. He left in the evening, he's going to sleep. He left the co-pilot, both second officers. The co-pilot and the other co-pilot are flying the plane, but it's the safest part of the flight. It should be fine. And so the plane's going, and all of a sudden, the air speed sensors go off. They can no longer see. The pilots can't tell how fast the plane is going. And that freaks them out because it's pitch black. You're over the ocean. There's no point of reference. You don't know how fast you're going. If you're going too fast, it could break the plane apart. You go too slow, it could stall. So they started to panic. Like, well, what's happening? Well, probably what happened is they flew into this weather system and the pitot tubes. If you ever get on a plane, look on the outside of the plane. There'll be these little copper tubes when you step through the door. And they'll usually say, like, don't put your foot here. Those are pitot tubes. And they measure the speed of the aircraft by processing the wind as it goes through it. Now, these tubes got clogged with ice crystals, so they couldn't tell the plane how fast it was going. And because the plane did not know how fast it was going, the autopilot disengaged. Now, here's the thing. Just fly straight. Just fly. In about a minute, the tubes will unclog. You'll be fine. That plane was perfectly fine. What happened was one of the co-pilots, Bonin, started to pull up. He just kind of panicked a bit and started pulling up, and that slowed the aircraft down. And because it slowed it down enough that it ended up stalling. And so it was angled up ever so slightly. And then it just starts to fall just out of the sky like a stone because the nose is tilted up. When the nose is tilted up, there's not enough air going over the wings to generate lift, and it just lightly starts to fall. It's not like it's angled down where you would feel it. That's what's deceptive about it. You don't even feel like you're falling. They would just look at the vertical speed indicator and the altimeter and see, you know, 29,000 feet, 28,000, 27,000. It's like, this can't be happening. We're angled up. We're pointed up. Why are we, what is happening here? So I'm going to play a clip from a documentary that includes some of the cockpit voice recordings and experts analyzing what happened in the situation. He's saying they're speaking in French. We're there. We're at flight level 100. Now they're at 10,000 feet, which is we're well past the danger zone now that they feel like, you know, what are we going to do?
That flying through, they saw flight level 100, which is 10,000 feet. I think that was a point where we went from, we have some time to figure this thing out, to like, we might not be able to save ourselves.
So he's saying, Tremont. He's saying, co-pilot Robert, the second pilot, is saying, climb. He's not understanding why the plane is not climbing, and he's at 7,600 feet. And then Bonin says, he said, but I've had the nose up for a while. And then the captain chimes in. The captain has come back from his rest break, by the way. When they've gone, he was back well before they were down 10,000 feet, but even he can't figure out what the problem here is. It was a lack of communication. Bonin was pulling back on the stick. The third officer, the least experienced pilot, was pulling back on the stick, having the nose, the angle of attack going up. That caused the stall and perpetuated the stall. Robert, the second officer, was pushing forward to angle it down, but Bonin and Robert's controls were not linked. On an Airbus, they're not linked. One was pushing forward, one was pushing, holding back. They canceled each other out, and they weren't communicating with each other. Then finally, they figure out what's going on, and Robert says, give me the controls, and so he's got the controls to fly the plane, but it's too late. They're past 4,000 feet, and they're falling too quickly, and then the plane just immediately slammed into the ocean, and all on board tragically perished. So that was Air France 447. You see there that the main problem was that aircraft was a perfectly capable aircraft to fly. It was because of pilot error. And pilot error will show up here in our next example. By the way, you keep in mind, I don't want you to listen to this and be afraid of flying, by the way. You know, I hear these things, it makes me think like, oh no. But imagine if I sat here and just told you about all the traffic accidents that happened today. I could tell you some pretty gruesome ones too that happened just today. Now, you've heard this before, you know, well, flying is safer than driving. And we hear that all the time, but it doesn't seep in because I think we have an irrational retort to that. When someone says, did you know that flying is way safer than driving? We always want to say this, yeah, but I've never died in a car that I was driving. I really do think that's what's going on in our heads when people tell us that. Like when we're in a car, it's like, well, when I'm driving the car, I'm totally safe. Those people that get in those, other people get into fatal car accidents, not me. So when we're flying, it's not a fear of flying. It's a fear of loss of control. Because if you and I, our flying was done by our own piloting, like, you know, we just got in our little planes, our flying cars, and we flew them places, and we did that over and over again, we really wouldn't be afraid of flying. In fact, we'd probably get risky. We would take unnecessary risks, and we would end up getting into more plane crashes that way. Because when you're afraid of flying, remember, tell yourself, it's not the plane I'm afraid of. I'm afraid that I'm not the one who's in control. And guess what? You can't be in control of everything in life. That is a lesson I am painfully trying to learn every single day. So let's go then to our next example of pilot error, Colgan Air Flight 3407. Marketed as Continental Connection under a code share agreement with Continental Airlines, was a scheduled passenger flight from Newark, New Jersey to Buffalo, New York, which crashed on Thursday, February 12, 2009. 2009 comes up a lot, actually. This is really the last time we had a major incident involving a domestic airline here within the United States of a loss of more than 50 people, or even less than that. We haven't had a major air incident in 10 years. I think the only fatality we've had on a plane was that Southwest flight. The engine exploded and shattered a window, and one woman died, I think, from blunt force trauma. Her head smacked against the window when the window exploded. But otherwise, if you look at that, in the past 10 years, planes have had an incredible safety record since the Colgan Air incident in 2009. They were flying a Bombardier Dash 8 Q400. It's basically a turboprop, a plane with propellers rather than jets. Entered an aerodynamic stall from which it did not recover and crashed into a house in Clarence Center, New York at 10:17 p.m., killing all 49 passengers and crew on board, as well as one person inside the house. National Transportation Safety Board conducted the accident investigation and published a report on February 2nd, 2010, which found the probable cause to be the pilot's inappropriate response to the stall warnings. So once again, the plane was in icing conditions. The plane is icing up. That's not necessarily fatal to a plane. There are countermeasures to de-ice wings and to overcome that. But they weren't aware that the plane was telling them, the computer was telling them, you know, you've got icing conditions, and telling them about the stall. And they reacted incorrectly and sent the plane into a dive. It seemed like their reactions were muted or hindered in some way, almost as if they were under the influence of alcohol. So a subsequent investigation found that what happened here, there were two things that were problematic. One, the flight officers broke the sterile cockpit rule. So it's a pilot and a co-pilot. And they were talking about stuff in their personal lives while they were flying under 10,000 feet. The sterile cockpit rule says that when you're below 10,000 feet, either taking off or landing, remember, these are the most sensitive parts of the flight, you are only to talk about matters related to flying the airplane, not that you're talking about your personal lives, your career goals, you know, things you're worried about, because you get distracted and you miss important things that can head up. When you're at 30,000 feet and the autopilot is flying, fine, you can talk about stuff, but not when you're under 10,000 feet. So they were distracted. And another thing that compounded their distraction was pilot fatigue. They were tired. These are regional airline pilots who were underpaid, and they didn't get enough sleep, so their reactions were hindered. They, you know, not muted is what I'm looking for, but their reactions were retarded. There, that's an okay use of the R word. their ability to respond was hampered in this incident because of their fatigue. They weren't like falling asleep, but they missed a few crucial seconds of where they needed to respond to the change in the flying condition. So here is one clip from an air crash investigation on this incident. The episode is actually called Dead Tired. And this is what they discovered contributed to the fatigue with the pilots.
And that neither pilot actually lived anywhere near Newark, but could not afford to stay in hotels on their salaries. Captain Renslow was earning $60,000 annually at Colgan Air. First Officer Shaw was being paid less than $16,000 a year, substantially less than an average bus driver. As a result, both pilots had made long cross-country commutes to Newark. Captain Renslow from his home in Florida, and Rebecca Shaw from Seattle, Washington. In fact, Shaw had commuted all night from Seattle on a cargo flight that connected through Memphis. Captain Renslow had spent the night in the airline's crew lounge at Newark Airport, after having already worked 2 days. He was seen sleeping on a couch in the lounge. It was against company rules, but pilots who couldn't afford housing near the airport did it anyway.
So there have been change in regulations since that, but I'm still always a little wary of the smaller regional airlines because the pilots are more inexperienced. But they're still good. If they're commercial pilots, they have to meet a certain threshold to be able to fly. But I'm still always concerned, though, about airlines, especially the small regional ones that try to get the best bang for their buck and shortchange the pilots in this regard. In fact, I saw the news earlier that there were some United Airlines pilots in Scotland. They were arrested because they were intoxicated, or at least they were higher than the legal limit for flying. And so United Airlines has changed their flight rule. It's called the bottle to throttle rule. You know, originally it was you can't drink any alcohol within 8 hours of flying a plane. Now they've upped that to 12 hours, which hopefully will keep pilots, functional and in their proper state of mind and health to be able to fly an airplane. All right, here is the last one before I get to the good news, the ones where pilots did, hey, great job, and we should have our faith in these good pilots that, you know, the vast majority of pilots are skilled, they're operating things well, they're doing a good job, and we should give them their due. But there's always going to be cases, human error factors into every single field that we take part in. Any transportation, power, energy, technology, there's always going to be human error that pops up. And the goal is we need to learn from incidents of human error so we can factor in safety systems or protocols to prevent that error from bringing about another tragedy. In this case, it's not so much, it's disputed. It's disputed in this crash, but I would say the evidence points clearly to not just human error, but human malice. This is one of the very rare cases of pilot suicide, where a pilot chooses to crash the plane because they're suicidal and so they want to crash a plane and they don't care that they kill all the other people on board. That's extremely rare. Now, in the United States, we've had a rule for a long time to prevent that from happening. It's called the two-person rule in the cockpit, that nobody can ever be left alone in the cockpit. So there always has to be two people there. So if one of the pilot or the co-pilot starts to, you know, become a bit unhinged or do something rash or irrational, there's someone else there who can fly the plane and can correct it. But however, a few years ago, you remember that German Wings flight, it was a regional carrier under Lufthansa in Europe. The co-pilot, Andreas Lubitz, crashed that plane. He locked the pilot out of the cockpit. The guy, you know, the pilot left to go on a bathroom break. And he was alone. He locked the door. The pilot couldn't get back in, and he just crashed the plane into the Alps. And so now Lufthansa, Air Canada, most of these other global carriers, other international carriers, have adopted the two-person co-pilot rule. The two-person rule was not being used. This was back in 1999 on Egypt Air Flight 990. So this is a case where one of the pilots, the co-pilot, I think his name was Al Djibouti, he was alone in the plane. And according to Wikipedia, this was a flight from Cairo to JFK. October 31st, 1999, the Boeing 767 crashed in the Atlantic Ocean about 60 miles south of Nantucket Island, Massachusetts, killing all 217 passengers on board. Because it was happening in international waters, there was an investigation by the Egyptian Civil Aviation Agency and the International Civil it was between Egypt, and then the NTSB was asked to take part in the investigation as well. So you had American investigators and Egyptian investigators. And basically what happened was that the American investigators said, this is very clear that the co-pilot acted irrationally and he purposely caused the plane to crash. And the Egyptian investigators did everything they could to say, no, it was an elevator failure. That's the thing that helps the plane to go up and down. It was a mechanical failure, and the pilot was trying to overcome it, and he couldn't. And they tried to explain away every absurd thing he did when it seems very clear that he was just intent on crashing the plane purposely. And the Egyptian authorities refused to take responsibility for it because they didn't want to make themselves look bad. So, I mean, it's an embarrassment when you look to see all the excuses they try to come up with for what is just very clear here. So I'm going to play a clip from a documentary that reenacts what happened.
I'll be back to you.
The timeline reveals that after Captain Al-Habashi leaves the cockpit, there's a series of sounds whose meaning can only be guessed at. And then the relief first officer disconnects the autopilot.
I rely on God.
Released from the autopilot's control, the plane starts to descend, rolling to the left. Egypt's experts described El Batuti's decision to shut off the autopilot as a possible reaction to an unusual movement of the aircraft, prompting him to take manual control. However, the leader of the NTSB investigation disagrees.
We found no reason for the autopilot to be disconnected by a fault or failure in the airplane.
Normally, all aircraft movements are meant to keep passengers comfortable, as though they were on the ground. After switching off the autopilot, El Batuti pushes his control column forward, lowering the elevator panels. So the flight data recorder indicates to the NTSB. Then he pulls the throttles back, reducing engine power. This causes the plane to dive. Egypt's investigators say El Batuti was not trying to crash the plane, and there may have been an elevator failure which he could not overcome. Strangely, there is no discussion of a problem on the cockpit tape.
Yeah, this is all very suspicious to me, that he disconnects the autopilot for no reason. He throttles back, pushes down, and he doesn't bother that if there was this serious incident to push the button on the flight attendant call button, the call button to say, I need the other pilots. He's the relief pilot. He's there so the other flight crew can take a break. If there, even that you have to take off the autopilot, push the button, say, hey, there might be a problem here, and bring other people into the situation. He doesn't do that. Instead, he kept repeating over and over and over again, I rely on God, I rely on God, I rely on God. And the Egyptian authorities try to explain that away, but it seems clear he's just trying to mollify himself, pacify himself before he does this horrible deed.
I
When the captain made his way back to the cockpit, he asked the first officer what was going on and never received a response.
So there, you know, that's one of the things that seals the deal for me, that, hey, why aren't they communicating with one another? Instead, no, it seems very clear you have a rogue agent on board who there was investigations also show that Al Djibouti was going to be fired. He had been credibly accused of like sexually harassing maids at the hotels that he was staying at. He was an embarrassment to Egypt Air. They were going to let him go. I think they told him he was going to be fired, and this was like his last flight. And so he decided to take that out on everybody else. All right, so that's the bad news. Now, can we please get to the good news? Yes, we can. Let me give you two incidents of where the pilots were amazing and saved the aircraft. So here's the first one. Air Canada Flight 143. This one is also called the Gimli Glider, and I'll tell you why. So on July 23rd, 1983, at an altitude of 41,000 feet, Air Canada Flight 143 ran out of fuel. Fuel tanks were dry. How in the world can that happen? Well, Canada was switching over to the metric system at the time, and so they did an improper calculation and didn't do a proper check of the tanks, and there was a mix-up in communication that resulted in them taking on 22,000 pounds of fuel when they actually needed 22,000 kilograms of fuel, and a kilogram is about 2.2 pounds. So they're out of fuel, and even worse, this model of aircraft, the hydraulic system, the electric system, it all required electricity that was generated by the jet engine spinning and operating. So when you run out of fuel, your electrical system goes down and your hydraulics don't work, so you basically have no ability to fly the plane. You have very, very minimal controls. But thankfully, the captain on board that day, he used to be a glider pilot. He knew all the techniques for how to glide a plane without engine control. So they were doing calculations thinking, maybe we can get to this airport or maybe we can get here. They eventually divert to Gimli Field, which was a Royal Canadian Air Force base in Gimli, Manitoba. So if you're, well, it's an old Air Force base, got a long enough landing strip, let's just go there. And they're going towards it, but they didn't realize that it had been converted into a go-kart track and a drag stripping race. So there were people there ready to race, and they're going to land the plane. And what's interesting here is there were like kids on the track in their golf carts, go-karts, ready to go. And there's this giant plane coming in behind them, but nobody can hear it. Like, you don't hear the plane. It would be a weird sight to see. You would just see this plane silently coming in to land because the jet engines aren't turning. They're not on anymore. And so as it comes on, they all had to like quickly get out of the way. And there's actually a news story here from City News Toronto talking about the 35th anniversary of the Gimli glider. And they've got an interview. He's a grown adult now, but talking about when he was a kid and what happened when he was on his go-kart on the track and they see this plane silently coming in out of nowhere about to land right on top of them.
And because he only had one shot to get it right, and he did not know that it had been converted to a racetrack.
We looked up into the sky and saw this giant airliner making its way through the sky.
Art Zook and his two friends were teenagers at the time, hanging out at the racetrack on their bikes. The friends, now referred to as the Runway Boys, saw as Captain Pearson angled the plane to slow down, but didn't realize it was heading right towards them.
And as it hit the ground, that was the only time I really heard a sound, and it was this deep thud, and you just felt the earth move. We didn't have a sense that it was heading our direction, and given the sideslip maneuver that Captain Pearson was doing, it was difficult to tell even which direction the plane was going. You see something that's that unbelievable, that incredible, it just takes a while for it to even sink in that this is really happening.
So a sideslip maneuver is where you turn the plane a bit. It's a gliding technique in order to slow the speed, because they were trying to slow the aircraft down as much as they can in order to make a successful landing. And really, it was the captain's glider knowledge that averted what could have been a catastrophe, a total loss of the airplane, passengers, and crew, and resulted in an actual successful landing without any fatalities. And now my last one for how pilots save planes. You've probably heard of this one. It's U.S. Airways Flight 1549, otherwise known as the Miracle on the Hudson. It took place January 15th, 2009, when the aircraft struck a flock of Canada geese just northeast of the George Washington Bridge. They consequently lost all engine power. Unable to reach any airport, pilots Chelsea Sullenberger, a.k.a. Sully, and Jeffrey Skills glided the plane to ditch in the Hudson River off from Midtown Manhattan. All 155 people aboard were rescued by nearby boats. There were a few serious injuries, but there were no fatalities. I mean, this is just amazing. They lost both engines at 2,000 feet. Remember the thing that I am most scared of, because the margin of error is incredibly small. You probably can't turn back and get to the airport in time. So what do you do? Now, they were looking, and I'm going to play the clip from the movie directed by Clint Eastwood based on this incident, because when you get to the very end, now, the movie about this takes a ton of dramatic license. The movie makes it seem like the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, wanted to blame Sully and say that he was reckless, when really they were behind him the whole time. They knew he did a great job and he acted properly under the circumstances. So it gets changed a bit to add drama to the film. But the end that shows how they landed. Now, I'm going to play this. I want you to listen, and I want you to watch for three things that pilots are supposed to do in an emergency situation. Aviate, navigate, communicate. I've said this before on an episode on, I think, crew resource management. Aviate, fly the plane. The number one thing is, no matter what you do, fly that plane, keep it up in the air, or bring it down safely. Navigate, figure out where you're going and get to where you're going safely. And the third thing, the least priority, is communicate. So I'll play this clip and you'll see what to do in an emergency situation to compare with like Air France 447 or, you know, Colgan Air, where the pilots are not attentive, they're not doing proper crew resource management. This is a textbook example about how pilots and co-pilots are supposed to communicate in order to avert a tragedy and deal with an unexpected situation. So listen to that, and I want you to notice how they aviate, they navigate, and they put the least priority on communicate, and they ignore air traffic control and only answer them when it's most pertinent or easy for them to do that. So here's the beginning of the scene right before the geese strike the plane.
Birds. One rolling back. We had both of them rolling back.
So there's speed, they're talking it out loud to assess the situation. They're both on the same plane.
Ignition start.
And they go right into the checklist.
I'm starting the APU.
APU is the auxiliary power unit. That's what they use. That it's a small turbine that can generate electrical power for them, even if the engines have shut down. It deploys from the plane and it spins to uses the airspeed that the plane is flying at to at least give them some electrical power.
My aircraft.
Your aircraft.
Get out the QRH.
Priority left.
Okay, notice there, my aircraft. I'm the one who's in charge. We're not both trying to solve it in different ways. We're on the same page. My aircraft.
Loss of thrust on both engines. Mayday, mayday, mayday. This is a Cactus 1549. Hit birds. We've lost thrust on both engines. We are turning back towards the LaGuardia.
Okay, you need to return to LaGuardia. Turn left heading 220.
220.
Which engine did you lose?
Both engines.
If your remaining engine mode, select your ignition. Ignition?
Ignition.
Thrust levers, confirm. Idle.
Idle.
Airspeed, optimum relay, 300 knots. We don't have that.
No, we don't.
Cactus 1549, if we can get it for you, do you want to try to land runway 13?
We are unable. We may end up at the Hudson.
Emergency electrical power, emergency generator not online.
Online.
ATC notified Squawk 7700. Distress.
Okay, so they're assessing the situation. They're able, you know, they're not panicking. And what you're doing is you have checklists. So you just go through a checklist. Now, what they ended up doing is that I think they went through the checklist to see what do you do when two engines are out at this altitude. There's not a scenario for that because it's not planned for it. It's incredibly rare. So they have to make it up as they go based on other situations. So they're aviating, they're navigating, they're trying to find a way back. They're trying to get back to LaGuardia, but they're recognizing that may not happen. And they're communicating only when they absolutely have to.
This is the captain. Brace for impact.
500.
Yeah. They're preparing.
1549, turn right 280. You can land runway 1 Teterboro.
We can't make it.
Okay, which runway would you like at Teterboro?
Go ahead, try number 1.
Number one. No relay.
We're going to end up in the Hudson.
And he's still doing everything he can to relight those engines, because a water landing is a dangerous thing. If you can't get it right, the jet engines on the planes, this is, you know, most planes have the engines under the wings. They act like giant scoops. So if you land just straight on to water, whether it's a river or the ocean or it's a lake, whatever it might be, those scoops will immediately catch in the water and the plane will flip over on its side or flip over end, front to back. And then you're gonna lose everybody on board. Planes are not meant to land in water. They can do that. So you pull a switch that closes off the valves on the plane to make sure to keep water from getting in. That's why, actually, if you read the emergency safety card, I'm sure you read the emergency safety card, don't you, every time you're on a plane? I don't. I've been on too many times. I almost have that darn thing memorized. If a plane lands in water, you don't open the doors in the back of the plane, because that's where the plane's going to start sinking, actually, is by its tail first. So if you open the emergency doors in the back of the plane, you're going to let water into the aircraft. And I think what happened on US Airways 1549 was that one of the passengers did open a door in the back, and that let in more water and hastened the sinking of the aircraft. Fortunately, there were no casualties, but that's why you gotta be prepared in those situations. And so in this scenario, Sully is trying to prepare to land the plane on water. And what he does, as you watch the rest of the film, you'll notice that he pulls back on the stick, he angles the nose up. You're trying to land it on the belly up, keeping the engines up in that process. And so that's our episode today on when pilot error brings down planes, but pilot genius and heroism can avert disaster. I hope it was edifying for you. If you want to check out that film, remember that the facts are stretched just a little bit. I still thought it was entertaining because Tom Hanks is a national treasure. The film is Sully, 2016 film directed by Clint Eastwood. Definitely one that I would check out in that regard. I hope you enjoyed your time with me today. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. Thank you all so much, and I hope you have a very blessed day.
If you liked today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.